that Mary was the focus of the celebrations, and Mary was what everybody worshipped, and Jesus was kind of a sideline. And even the rosary, you know, Hail Mary, Mother God, the Lord is with thee, blessed art thou, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. As I recall, I used to know the rosary. Pray for us now in the hour of death, whatever. That came to an end with the printing press. That when we started learning to be literate, that the left side of our brain kind of rose up and took over, that controls the right side of our body. And when we started learning abstract alphabets before the age of 7, that it neurologically altered us, and literally within a generation of the decriminalization of reading in Western Europe, you saw widespread. First of all the Mary shrines were torn down. The Mary dedicated churches were changed to Jesus churches. And mm-hmm. you saw women being tortured and murdered and hung and right. burned as witches.
You know, it's kind of interesting because it really goes back to this idea, and I'm sure you're probably aware of it in philosophy, and it's within the Western mind much more than the Eastern mind, is a kind of dualism that we have to do the nasty work of the world by dividing it up this way.
Right.
And, you know, it is antithetical, really, to the basis of Christianity, in my opinion, but it's not just my opinion. I think it's of, you know, a lot of people who have really studied this, you know, the history of the church.
Oh, read Elaine Pagel's work. I believe it's Robert Funk's work, The Five Gospels. Read the Gospel of Thomas. You know, Jesus said, lift a rock, I am there. Split wood, I am there. I mean, it was essentially pantheism.
Yeah, I mean, we've taken our very soul, according to a lot of churchmen, and we've divided it up, and you know, to allow us to create this material.
Well, and we even divided divinity into three pieces. You know, the Holy Trinity, the Father, the Spirit, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and all are characterized as male. None are characterized as female.
Well, you know, I have to disagree with you on that, because actually the idea of the Trinity is a continual flow of love from one being to the other. And so it's a very difficult concept to understand, and I don't necessarily think of it in terms of male or female. But
well, Father and Son are male words, John. Fathers and sons have penises.
Yeah,
where
yeah,
is the female word?
I think we've identified, you know, maleness with a kind of a very material kind of word, instead of understanding it in a sense, in an abstract sense. I mean, yeah. to say that you really know that, you know, God is male, like, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger, is absolutely categorically false.
And yet it's what most people believe who are, quote, people of the book, you know, Christians, Jews, and Muslims. God and gods are always expressed as males, or almost always. John, thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at stamps.com. And our website, tomhartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at tomhartman.com. Thank you.
October 30th at 10 p.m., tune into KBOO Community Radio for a special documentary on the Neo Boys. This one-hour special features interviews with KT, Kim, Meg, Pat, and Jennifer, as well as previously unreleased Neo Boys songs featured on their double album retrospective Sooner or Later, which was released this month.
For Neo Boys, it created this huge loyalty.
I didn't need some kind of broad cultural acceptance.
There's a spirit that from that time that just stays with you.
That anything's possible. You can do, you can create anything.
It was a really great thing.
October 30th, from 10 to 11 p.m., the Neo Boys documentary on the DIY punk radio show Life During Wartime, right here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to help co-sponsor the Visegrad Group PDX Festival, November 9th from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Polish Hall, 3832 North Interstate Avenue in Portland. To celebrate the 95th anniversary of independence of the Czech, Polish, and Hungarian nations, this one-day festival will share traditions, history, arts and crafts, and national food of the Czech, Polish, and Hungarian communities within Multnomah County. Again, the Visegrad Group PDX Festival will take place at the Polish Hall, 3832 North Interstate Avenue, on Saturday, November 9th, from 1 to 7 p.m. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com. Now the evening news.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland City Council restores funding to assist youth human trafficking victims.
India will begin taking measures to secure itself from NSA snooping.
A tense situation is unfolding as Portland police talk with a suicidal man on Vista Bridge.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 30th, 2013. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Sean Stewart. The Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters had two demonstrations today, protesting businesses that use non-union carpenters or contractors with ongoing labor disputes. One such picket took place at Nordstrom. The other was at Wentworth Chevrolet, where KBOO reporter Robin Ryan spoke with protesters.
Wentworth Chevrolet has hired a contractor who hires subcontractors that don't pay the area wage and benefits for carpenters in the area. And we just think that the public should know that, because we think that they should be more responsible in the community.
Hey, I'm Robin Ryan. I'm with KBOO News. And I'm just curious as to how you guys get to a point where you have to stand outside with a sign that says, "Shame on Wentworth Chevrolet."
It has to do with area standard wages and benefits. We believe everybody should be paid a fair wage and a benefit package for skilled labor.
And R&H Construction is hiring folks that are not skilled labor or substandard wages?
Yeah, what we'd like for you to do there is you could give them a ring, give the general manager of Wentworth, Lou Harrison, a ring, and ask him what his point of view is on that.
Can I get your name?
Mike Logan.
A tense negotiation between Portland police officers and a suicidal man atop a Southwest Portland bridge is now in its sixth hour. Police officers responded at 10:30 this morning to a report of a man perching on a railing of the historic Vista Bridge. The man appears to have climbed over a suicide prevention barrier recently built to curb a rash of suicides and suicide attempts involving the bridge. Four people have committed suicide by jumping off Vista Bridge since the start of 2013. The disturbing trend prompted a band of concerned citizens to form a coalition known as Friends of the Vista Bridge. The coalition began running volunteer patrols and rallied the city to construct a temporary suicide barrier around the bridge. Construction was completed October 1st. Critics of the suicide barrier, including local mental health advocates, say the net will do little to deter those determined to commit suicide, and that city funds are better directed toward preventive mental health services. Negotiations such as the one playing out atop the bridge right now are proof positive that the barrier is doing its job, according to Friends co-founder Ken Kahn, who said, quote, "The fence is doing what it's supposed to do, create a pause for people considering suicide," end quote. Kahn said he is extremely optimistic that the negotiation will end without a suicide. The net has played a part in preventing at least three suicides since its construction, Kahn added. There have been no suicides committed off of Vista Bridge since summer.
75-year-old John Schweibert was among the group of people arrested at the post office yesterday and arraigned this afternoon. He faces charges for trespassing and is expected to return to court in 2 weeks. KBOO's Robin Ryan asked him about how the situation escalated to a confrontational moment between activists and post office security.
Share with our listeners what's happened with your life in the last 24 hours or so.
Well, I was, of course, involved in a protest with the Communities and Postal Workers United, trying to continue our process of trying to get some conversation with postal managers. And in the process of doing that, we were involved in I can't call it a sit-in, but a stand-in at the central post office, the main post office.
And you were among a group of people arrested?
I was among seven of those who were arrested. There were about 15 that were present in the room, which was a foyer outside the elevators on the third floor of the post office. And I was one of seven who were arrested because we refused to leave until we had an agreement with the postal manager of a date and time for a meeting, and the promise that meeting would take place.
Had there been any prior dialogue with this manager, and had this manager indicated that they were prepared to meet with your group?
The several managers have been contacted by correspondent several times, and in the case of the kind of the head manager who got the last letter, she didn't even dignify us with a reply. She asked a subordinate to send us a letter telling her that she was unwilling to meet with us.
And did her letter or her emissary explain on what grounds she could refuse?
Yeah, she said because we wanted to talk about privatizing the postal service and the things that are happening locally that are a part of that privatization process. And she said, which I believe was an untruth, that decisions about privatization hadn't been made yet at the headquarters level. And until those decisions were made, we had nothing to talk about.
Were you assaulted yesterday, sir?
Postal service person, he actually did tell me that I had to leave. And when I told him that we were not planning to leave the premises until we had the assurance that we would have a meeting with the postal manager, he said to me, "That's not going to happen," meaning that meeting is not going to take place, and therefore you have to leave. And I said, "Well, we're not going to leave." At that point, he took my arm and tried to force me into the elevator to be removed from the building.
And you just finished your arraignment hearing. Can you tell us what the next step is going to be?
I've been charged with trespass, too, and in about 2 weeks, I will appear for a trial.
I want our listeners to understand the individual that this security person put their hands on.
I'm a retired clergyman. I served three different churches in Portland for the last 40 years before my retirement.
I hope you don't think it's disrespectful of me to ask you how old you are.
Oh, I'm 75 years old, yeah. The Postal Service is working, but even the Postmaster General is part of those that are trying to degrade it to the point where it can be taken over by private corporations.
Do you know the names of these companies that might be driving this interest in privatization?
Pitney Bowes is a possibility, and of course FedEx and United Parcel all have an interest in it.
Mr. Schweibert, thank you so much for taking the time. We'll check back with you in a couple weeks to see how the judicial proceedings go.
Okay, great. Thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. I've been talking with 75-year-old John Schweibert. He was arrested yesterday with six other demonstrators at the United States Postal Service standing opposed to privatization of public services. This is Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
Work has been extended to replace a 100-year-old water main which broke early Tuesday morning on 4th and Burnside. Crews initially estimated the repair work to be completed today, but the amount of flood water and ground saturation has caused the city to move the estimate of completion to Sunday. As a result of the break, eastbound traffic on Burnside between 2nd and 5th Streets will be closed until the repairs are completed. The Portland Bureau of Environmental Services also attributes the main break to being a contributing factor to a sewage leak yesterday morning. KBOO reporter Jemai Cherry spoke with Link Mann, a spokesperson for the Bureau, to find out the impact of the leak.
Today, there was a press release that was issued that said that there was a sewage release in the Willamette. Can you just give a brief explanation of what happened?
Yes. Early Tuesday morning, a water main broke, a drinking water main on West Burnside, right around Southwest 4th Avenue. That neighborhood has a combined sewer system, and a combined system is one that combines two types of wastewater in one pipe. It combines stormwater runoff from the streets into the combined sewer, and it also collects and carries sanitary sewage from homes and businesses. That's a combined sewer pipe. So when this water main broke, a lot of water went into the catch basins, into the inlets in the street, which carry the water to the combined sewer system. A combined sewer trunk line carried a lot of water to our Ankeny pump station, which is in Waterfront Park. And from that point, the water flowed through a valve and through an outfall pipe into the Willamette River. So we call that a sanitary sewer overflow.
Okay, and you said that this all took place at the valve at the Ankeny pump station?
The Ankeny pump station is going through some renovation right now. It's a long-term project to modernize and upgrade that pump station. So the stormwater pumps inside the pump station aren't operational at the moment because of the renovation project. As soon as the workers there noticed a plume of dirty water coming out of that outfall pipe, they investigated and discovered what was going on and closed that valve to stop the overflow.
Okay, and when is the renovation work supposed to be completed on it?
Okay, we've been working on that for a long time. It's a pretty major upgrade. We're just replacing almost all the equipment in the pump station. It started in the spring of 2012, and it looks like it will go until spring 2014. So sometime this coming spring, we'll be done with it.
Okay, well, is there a possibility of further sewage release into the Willamette, like with the upcoming rainy season?
You know, there are two kinds of sewage releases. There are sanitary sewer overflows, which is what we had yesterday morning, and there are combined sewer overflows. And even though the combined sewer was part of this problem, this wasn't a combined sewer overflow. It was a sanitary sewer overflow. A combined sewer overflow occurs when our Willamette River tunnels the east side big pipe and the west side big pipe, fill to capacity, and then some of the mixture of stormwater and sewage overflows into the Willamette River. It takes quite a bit of rain, hard rain for quite a long duration to create a sewer overflow since our CSO tunnel system went online. We used to have something like, on the average, 50 CSO events every year. We activated the CSO tunnel system in November 2011, and since then we've had six CSO events. So it takes a great deal of rain to create a CSO these days.
Anything else that you wanted to possibly make mention for some of our listeners that might have concerns about sewage release when they hear you know, a statement like a sewage release in the Willamette, you know, worst case scenario usually kicks in.
Whenever we have sewage going into the Willamette River, that increases bacteria in the water. So we like to let people know where it flowed in and just advise that they avoid contact with the water in that area for a couple of days. We don't know in this case. Usually we have an idea of the volume of the spill, but in this case, since we don't know exactly when it began, we don't know when it ended. We don't have an estimate of how much went in. So as a precaution, we're just asking people to try to avoid contact with water at the west end of the Burnside Bridge, which is where the Ankeny Pump Station is located.
Thank you very much, Link.
Okay, you're welcome.
This is Jemai Cherry with KBOO News.
In Hillsborough, Intel is planning a new D1X expansion, which will increase its manufacturing output. With the expansion, the factory will produce additional gases emissions, which has attracted the attention of neighborhood and environmental activists who want to see the emissions regulated. The expansion's permitting process with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality was not put up for public discussion. So many voices were not heard in the decision promoting a civil suit by the Northwest Environmental Defense Center. Because of community concerns and the suit, Intel may have to reapply for its permit for additional emissions. To find out about the case, KBOO's Peter Schoaf spoke with John Krall, the staff attorney for Neighbors Clean Air. For more information, you can visit whatsinourair.org.
Yes, I'm John Krallman. I'm the staff attorney for Neighbors for Clean Air.
Today I wanted to talk about Intel's emission of fluoride, among other things, and they're applying to get repermitted. So what is the Neighbors for Clean Air stance on that?
Neighbors for Clean Air is dedicated to making Oregon's clean air laws and regulations focus on air toxics and health. We work with communities around Oregon to understand and try to address the issues of toxic air. A lot of industry emits air toxics. Intel, because of the way their process works, emits a variety of different air toxics, what we call hazardous air pollutants, or HAPs. The D1X expansion is increasing the amount of fluorides. Not all of those are hazardous air pollutants, but some of them are. Portland metro area has a significant problem with air toxic. A DEQ study, the Portland Air Toxic Solution, did modeling of a number of pollutants, and the levels were sometimes more than 100 times what DEQ had sent as a health benchmark or a health goal. Those are regulated because fluoride ions can have a very serious health impact. Fluorides can cause serious health problems, especially some of the ones that Intel is emitting. So we're concerned about the increased emissions there, and also the fact that there was no public process involved in approving that expansion.
What sort of public process should Intel have gone through to approve its expansion?
Well, the approval of the expansion was done using what's called a notice of intent to construct. Had they gone through the correct process because of their increase in fluoride emissions, that would have involved a public hearing. So there's a lot more public knowledge and involvement in the permitting scheme than in the notice of intent to construct. We noticed, you know, this violation of the Clean Air Act, and we're hoping that we can work with Intel to develop a positive solution.
So if the Title V permit was filled out correctly, would the EPA still need to get involved to oversee under the Clean Air Act?
EPA does have authority to oversee the Title V permitting. All of those permits are sent to EPA for their review. If EPA wants to, a lot of the times they simply say, we're not bothering to review this, but we reserve the right to object to it if we find out later that it's not in compliance with the law. Citizen groups also under Title V of the Clean Air Act can petition EPA to object to a permit. After EPA's review period, the state is allowed to then issue the permit, and citizens have a time frame, 60 days, to send a petition to EPA asking them to object to the permit, and then EPA is required to respond to that petition. So there is a process for EPA to be involved in the Title V permitting process. I think that the public outcry here is not not really centered around fluoride. I mean, part of it definitely is sort of this increase in fluoride emissions. A lot of it has to do with sort of just the amount of air, hazardous air pollutants coming from Intel and the lack of public involvement in the approving the expansion, that the public was sort of shut out of that decision-making process from the environmental side.
Is there anything the public can do to get involved in the DEQ's permitting
decision?
Well,
we're working with community representatives. Some of our members are very active in the community in the area. But if anybody is interested in helping out, they can certainly talk with Neighbors for Clean Air or Northwest Environmental Defense Center, NEDC. We're working in negotiations or beginning negotiations with Intel.
I was speaking with John Krallman of Neighbors for Clean Air. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Peter Schoaf.
The Portland City Council unanimously authorized today nearly $250,000 in funding for a local program aimed at helping local victims of human trafficking. Janus Youth Programs provides round-the-clock response and advocacy services for underage victims of sexual exploitation in the Portland area. Janus also runs Athena House, a group home for sexually exploited youth. Counselors approved today $177,000 to support the provision of shelter beds and treatment for these victims. Per an emergency clause requested by Mayor Charlie Hale, the council also restored $70,000 in funding cut from the program earlier this year. Janus's Athena House is just one of several efforts underway aimed at curbing Portland's human trafficking problem. In July, the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office established a human trafficking team to more closely monitor the issue and ensure tougher penalties for pimps. However, the 2013-2014 budget approved by City Council in June slashed funding for Janus, the trafficking team, and a variety of other anti-trafficking efforts. The restored funding will ensure that essential services are provided to exploited youth even after they age out of the system, said Commissioner Amanda Fritz.
The mayor is proposing to restore the $70,000 that he cut in the budget as part of the full bump. And that would expand the services provided by Janus Youth to allow youth who are currently aging out of the system to continue to receive services from age 18 to 24. That part is coming in the bump. This is for the staffing of the Athena House. Janus Youth does amazing work with some of the most vulnerable people in our community, the youth victims of human trafficking. I'm glad to see this funding coming through. I hope to see support for the additional funding in the full bump, and I will be bringing an additional item to council in November requesting more money for human trafficking survivors.
That was Commissioner Amanda Fritz speaking today at Portland City Council meeting about the City Council's unanimous decision to authorize nearly $250,000 in funding for a local program aimed at helping local victims of human trafficking. Also in today's City Council meeting, the city heard testimony from District Council of Trade Unions regarding the necessity of unions to ensure good city services.
My name is Mary Protzman. I'm a non-sworn employee of the Portland Police Bureau, active steward and trustee of AFSCME Local 189. The City of Portland is a good employer, but it's proven throughout the DC2 contract negotiations to be a lousy partner. AFSCME Local 189 elected new leadership this past winter, and in our strategic planning session, two of our five goals included reestablishing good working relations with the HR and the apparently unobtainable goal of providing better services to more of the city with more efficiency through labor and management working together as collaborative partners. I live, play, and work in this city, and as a frontline unionized worker, I am part of a massive effort to provide the services that make this place so livable. Stop lowering our standards of service. A new community survey out of our auditor's office shows an overall decline in satisfaction of city services. Doing more with less stops working after a while, and asking frontline workers to sacrifice time and time again, doing more with less and less, is compromising the investment in Portland's future. I'm supposed to have a living wage job working for the city, but it's getting harder to afford to even live here. I have postponed starting a family of my own because I cannot afford that either. This is not an ask for money. This is about city management wasting everyone's time with petty stall tactics that result in a real small financial saving. This is about the rights of middle-class workers to bargain collectively and progressively to make our entire community stronger. As elected officials, you have the power to stop management's dawdling at the table, Stop trying to bust city unions and stop trying to balance our financial shortfalls on the backs of the labor trying to keep this city clean, safe, prosperous, and awesome. If the council's concerned about the bottom line of the city, then the council should be concerned about the bottom line of...
That was a clip of testimony from Mary Protzman on the issues faced by city workers in Portland, recorded at this morning's city council meeting.
Stay tuned for after this newscast for a live interview hosted by KBOO's Erin J. Bernard. She'll speak with Arun Gupta with Occupy Wall Street about the effects of Superstorm Sandy a year later and how capitalists on Wall Street have profited from the storm. At 6, it's Occupy Radio. On tonight's show, host Jimmy Tardy brings us a special program on transcendental activism. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather brings us an end to the long dry spell we've had, with rain showers in the morning that should dissipate by the time kids head out to trick-or-treat in the evening. Chance of rain is 50%. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count report in the world, we bring you the latest radiation count for your area. In North Portland, the count is 38 counts per minute, or CPM, with spikes up to 57. In Powell Butte, it's 34 CPM, spiking at 45. Damascus, Oregon, has 31 CPM, also spiking at 45. In Beaverton, the radiation count is 33 CPM, spiking at 48. Seaside, Oregon, measures 27 CPM today. Hanford, Washington, is at 34 CPM, spiking at 39. And Vancouver, British Columbia, has a radiation count of 26 counts per minute, spiking at 36. For more radiation counts and information on what they mean, look for No Nukes Northwest on Facebook.
It's 5:32, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
What a show the goofily fanatical Tea Party Republicans are putting on in Washington. First, they threw a group hissy fit to force a costly, embarrassing, and entirely unwarranted shutdown of the national government of our U.S. of A. That was strange enough, but then a gaggle of the goofballs cranked their stick all the way up to Code Red Bazaar by throwing a series of stage tantrums when they learned that the government they had shut down was, in fact, shut down. I know you don't have to be smart or logical to be in Congress, but surely a lawmaker ought to be more tightly wrapped than this bunch. One thing that really worked them into a shrieking frenzy was that national parks and monuments were closed. This led to the spectacle of a House committee hauling in the director of national parks to berate him mercilessly for 5 hours, demanding to know why the parks were closed. He should have just held up a mirror, but, like the good career park ranger he is, Director John Jarvis patiently tried to explain the obvious to the Congress critters in front of him. They had voted to shutter the federal government. National parks are part of the government. Congress took away the money to staff the nation's 401 parks and monuments, so they were closed. But the rabid Solons effectively shouted at him, "Stop making sense!" One doofus named Doc Hastings even invented his own facts, blathering that in the government shutdown back in the mid-90s, parks stayed open. Sorry, Doc, but no. The Lincoln Memorial, Statue of Liberty, Grand Canyon, and others all across the country were closed. That's what it means to shut down the government. This is Jim Hightower saying, by the way, guess who has been steadily whacking funding for Park Service staff and maintenance of those national treasures? Right, the same Looney Tune ideologues running today's absurd circus in Washington.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A Santa Rosa, California boy who was shot and killed by a Sonoma County Sheriff's deputy, was laid to rest yesterday at a memorial service in protest. 13-year-old Andy Lopez was holding a BB gun, which the sheriff's department says resembled an AK-47 assault rifle, when he was gunned down last week. The incident had been reported to have taken place in a span of 10 seconds. The identity of the shooter was released yesterday as Deputy Eric Gelhaus, a 24-year veteran of the sheriff's department. According to his LinkedIn profile, Gelhaus is a weapons expert and is an instructor for the Gunsight Academy, a school for firearm training. Gelhaus also served in the Iraq War as an arms trainer and contributed to online law enforcement forums, including one with a thread which discusses several options on how to deal with a suspect who has a BB gun. Gelhaus is currently on suspension and the incident is under investigation. Sonoma County Sheriff deputies have shot and killed 3 people this year.
The National Security Administration of America has come under scrutiny from the international community after the betrayal of its foreign spying attempts by Edward Snowden. Governments across the world are taking measures to secure their information from the prying eyes of Uncle Sam, as in the case of Russia switching to typewriters and paper documents to protect government secrets. And India is the latest country to develop such countermeasures. Documents published in the Hindu newspapers have revealed India to be the 5th most intensively watched country in the world, with over 6 billion communications intercepted over the month of June. To prevent international spying, India's IT minister, Kapil Sibal, announced plans to restrict use of foreign cloud-based emails, which he hopes to effect by December. Sibal also requested that staff workers at the National Informatics Center use virtual private networks when working abroad to further encrypt communications. Brazil, whose president, Dilma Rousseff, has been a vocal opponent of international spying, also plans to produce an encrypted secure email protocol. India is not only working to prevent foreign spying, but it is also setting up its own system to intercept data, called the Centralized Monitoring System.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine, from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, October 30th, 2013. Israeli settlers uproot Palestinian-owned olive trees and troops issue demolition orders against a number of Palestinian homes in Jerusalem. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A group of Israeli settlers uprooted on Wednesday 600 olive trees owned by Palestinian farmers from the village of Ein Abus, south of Nablus city in northern West Bank. Villagers said that the settlers came from the nearby Yitzhar illegal Israeli settlement. Farmers said that they only can access their land after coordinating with the Israeli army because the land are close to the illegal settlement. The farmers say the destruction of trees happened over days and the army did not stop it. Elsewhere, the Israeli army handed out demolition orders to 5 Palestinian families in Silwan neighborhood in occupied East Jerusalem. According to the army, the homes are built without the needed permission from the military, which is rarely given to Palestinian residents of Jerusalem. In other news, the Israeli government has announced that it intends to build additional 1,500 units for Jewish settlers in the illegal settlement of Ramat Shlomo in occupied East Jerusalem. The announcement came shortly after Israel released 26 veteran Palestinian detainees as part of the diplomatic talks between Tel Aviv and the Palestinian Authority of President Mahmoud Abbas. The decision did not come as a surprise, as Netanyahu and his coalition partners said they would build more settlements in return for freeing Palestinian political prisoners, and allegedly that President Mahmoud Abbas agreed to this formula. President Abbas told those gathered in Ramallah to welcome the released political prisoners that he never accepted the release of detainees in return for accepting Israel's settlement activities. Tel Aviv will be releasing more detainees on December 29th and on March 28th, 2014. The release is part of an agreement mediated by the United States to ensure the resumption and continuation of peace talks that were halted for 3 years due to ongoing Israeli violations, including invasions, arrests, and ongoing settlement activities. The agreement is meant to ensure the release of all 104 detainees held by Israel since before 1993 on 4 stages. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, October 30th, 2013, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Banmoura.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. 1,000 janitors in Columbus, Ohio are battling a big corporation that's trying to reduce the $18,000 a year janitors to part-time. Their health care benefits are also at stake. SEIU Local 1's Tyler French says ABM Industries, a big corporation that handles office building cleaning nationwide, is the anti-worker villain in this story.
ABM is insisting, even after a year of negotiations, that all full-time janitors should be part-time in our city. That has dire consequences for the hardworking people that are fighting every day just to get by and survive. This would mean not only elimination of up to 50% of household income for janitors, but also complete lack of health insurance.
French says this may be the start of an all-out effort by cleaning companies to roll back the gains SEIU has made for janitors, starting with its Justice for Janitors campaign many years ago.
Since the inception of the Justice for Janitors campaign, we've made a lot of strides. But what we're seeing today is the beginning of a possible national war to try and roll back the standards that janitors have won in hard-fought battles across the country.
French says Columbus janitors are on the job now, but rolling strikes have occurred in the city, and he says the janitor strikes are going to spread across the region as janitors resist efforts to force them into part-time status with no health insurance. One of the next battlegrounds for marriage equality is in Virginia, where 2 federal lawsuits are advancing in the legal process this week. In addition to respect and dignity, proponents say ending the ban on same-sex marriage will provide couples with the securities and benefits necessary to protect their families. From Richmond, Catherine Comp reports.
The 2 suits seek to invalidate the state's ban on same-sex marriage and civil unions, and its refusal to recognize legal marriages from other states. Reducing this inequality, says Nancy Wolforth, founder of the AFL-CIO's Pride at Work initiative, will help working families across the state.
People who are able to get benefits for their entire family improves their life immensely, immediately, because they can cover their spouse and their children under a state employee's health plan.
Same-sex couples in Virginia are denied more than 1,000 other rights and benefits, including those concerning tax breaks, adoption, and perks given to military spouses.
It's a human rights issue.
The 2 cases are known as Harris v. McDonnell and Bostick v. McDonnell. Some legal experts say one of them could end up at the U.S. Supreme Court. Catherine Comp, Richmond.
A Pittsburgh woman says she has cut through the malfunctioning government healthcare website to get Affordable Care Act insurance. Gail Roach was paying $509 a month for a retirement healthcare package. On the phone with a healthcare specialist, her premium dropped to just $70 a month. And after a tax credit and a feature called cost-sharing benefit, her premium will be an astonishingly low $1.11 a month.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Aaron J. Bernard, Peter Schoaf, Robin Ryan, and Jimmy Tardy. The producer is Jamai Cherry. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers. So get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Sean Stewart.
J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, hear Voices from the Edge, progressive talk radio from a grassroots perspective with Joanne Hardesty. Then, Per Fagerang hosts a special hour-long edition of Fight the Empire with a focus on the history of Pacifica Radio and the documentary KPFA on the Air. His guest is radio producer Maria Gilardin of TUC Radio. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio. At 11, on Between the Covers, host David Nyman interviews Lucy Corin about her new collection of short stories called 100 Apocalypses and Other Apocalypses. And at 11:30, hear Improbability Drive. Author, travel writer, and blogger Joshua Samuel Brown explores the uses and pitfalls of social media with writers from a variety of disciplines. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in our recent membership drive. You make this station possible.
Brings the listening public the other point of view.
There was a strong sense that this was the beginning of something that would spread across the country.
On Sunday, November 3rd, at the historic Hollywood Theater, KBOO presents an exclusive benefit screening of the film KPFA on the Air.
This documentary tells the powerful story of the beginnings of listener-sponsored radio in the United States with the birth of Pacifica in Berkeley in 1949.
KPFA on the Air chronicles the origins of the free speech movement, the first stirrings of the student movements at Berkeley, and opposition to the Vietnam War in the early 1960s.
Eventually spawning a network of free-form, independent radio stations across the country, including KBOO, which came on the air in 1968. So come join us at the Hollywood Theater, Northeast 41st and Sandy Boulevard, Sunday, November 3rd, at 7 in the evening.
Help keep community radio strong and thriving into the future.
Muertos Northwest invites you to the 5th annual Dia de los Muertos celebration, Saturday, November 2nd, at the Audio Cinema, 226 Southeast Madison Street, Portland, under the Hawthorne Bridge. Celebration of life and death. Come help the spirits of your loved ones return with their favorite food, drinks, and plenty of dancing. Bring an item to add to the community altar. Muertos face painting for the young and old, sugar skull decorating, hot chocolate and pan dulce will be served. Come check out Mariachi Portland, Conjunto Alegre, and Rafa and the Deadliest Catch Band. Come for the Muertos, stay for the food, drinks, and dancing. Sponsored in part by KBOO, Tequila Cuervo, and Cover Oregon. Visit Facebook Muertos Northwest.
Good people, KBOO 90.7 FM Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Afro-Caribbean All Music Festival. 9 bands will play genres and rhythms all originating from Africa, including Afro Jazz, Calypso, Samba, Salsa, Reggae, and others. The event will feature the bands Jujuba, Love Nesuesa, Super Mokako, Roots Revolution, and others. The festival will be held on November 1st, 2nd, and 3rd at the TAQ Center, 631 Northeast Grand Avenue, Portland, from 7 p.m. until 2:30 a.m. Come dance for 3 nights straight at the Afro-Caribbean All Music Festival, November 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. More information can be found on the right-hand side of the KBOO.fm website under Community Events.
today. Make my getaway. St. Louis woman with her diamond ring pulls that man around by her apron string. If it wasn't for powder and her store-bought hair, cast in the sea, or else he wouldn't have gone so far from me.
Listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. Had to play a few tracks, had some sewage problems. The first track you guys heard tonight was Billie Holiday and St. Louis Blues, and we heard from Massive Attack with Radiation Ruling the Nation, and just now heard from Dim Sums, D-I-M-S-U-M-Z, with Dim Jazz. And back to Aaron.
This week marks the one-year anniversary of Superstorm Sandy, and I'm speaking with Arun Gupta, who is co-founder of the Occupy Wall Street Journal and a founding editor of the award-winning grassroots New York City newspaper, The Independent. Arun, thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you.
So can you talk a little bit about how New York City is managing a year after Sandy?
Well, I think the real story is one of displacement, that thousands of people have been displaced because of Sandy. The community's really torn apart. What the policy really has been is to leave everything to market forces. So the government has used buyout programs. They've also, we've seen developers come in a large way, whether it's small-scale speculators or big real estate developers that have bought up whole apartment blocks, particularly on the Rockaways, which was one of the most devastated areas by Sandy. And so I think this has really ripped communities apart and certainly not helped in terms of the healing process.
So can you talk a little bit more about what you mean when you write about disaster capitalism?
Yeah, so there's profiteering. So in one instance, there was these developers who came in and bought this block of housing that had previously been low income. It had been state subsidized on the Rockaways, hundreds of apartment buildings. Many, if not most of the tenants were receiving some sort of state assistance or another, whether this was rental assistance, Medicaid, food stamps, Social Security, that sort of thing. Of course, you know, things that people can and should be entitled to. And they bought it up. And what they started doing was, quote unquote, fixing it up. But the model is always based on raising the rental prices. So they are pushing people out to be able to finance the, quote unquote, investment. But what this means is that you're depriving people of their houses. And because it, a lot of it is happening on within subsidized buildings, what we're seeing is then the public ends up subsidizing this private profit at literally the cost of people's lives. And this is just, you know, one example. A lot of middle class homeowners, they're, after the storm, their homes were completely destroyed, but the land is still valuable. So speculators were coming in and offering them, you know, like 50, 60% of what the home had been worth that literally just a few weeks earlier. And people often had no choice but to take the offer because they still had so much in mortgage that they had to pay off, and they couldn't afford to rebuild. And so what it does is it kind of naturalizes a process. You're like, oh, everything's left up to the market. This is natural. But what it does is it hides how the state is subsidizing this process in all sorts of ways, you know, because home ownership is subsidized by the state. All the infrastructure is subsidized by the state. All the cleanup emergency services, those are all state activities. And yet, so it's structured in such a way that the private developers can come in and profit from those state activities, but it's presented as, oh, this is a natural private phenomena.
So are there other solutions on the table that might provide a more egalitarian solution to disasters like this?
Well, you know, there was Occupy Sandy, and I'm one of a number of people who have been critical of this effort. I think initially what the activists did was great, was incredible in terms of stepping into the breach where the state was not. But really, after the first week or two, what it started to become was basically, activists were taking on the role of the state, whereas there is no way you're going to have the capacity to do this. And then it also leads to many questionable decisions in a number of instances. What winds up happening is you have these activists who are basically working for free, spending hundreds if not thousands of hours rehabbing private property, right? It's like, this is not something that's in the social interest. Then you're also dealing with traumatized communities. One of the arguments has been is like, oh, we're kind of seeding new political movements and showing people, you know, how Occupy Wall Street can act in an effective way in building these links to communities. But you're dealing with, you know, people who may have lost loved ones. They certainly lost their homes or the places of residents, or they were abandoned in the dark without electricity for weeks.